second in our fall seminar series. Very happy to have here Professor Ted Gerber from the Sociology Department, one of the leading sociologists in the country, who also is working on our
one of the few sociologists.
Also former director of CRECA, presenting on, as the title suggests, ethnic and other sources of ideational cleavage. I assume this goes along with, builds on some of Ted's existing survey research. Is this a new survey?
Well, in survey terms,
it's relatively new. Ted, a leading survey researcher, in addition to being a leading sociologist, a leading survey researcher on the region, whose work is actually used not only by sociologists, but by political scientists and other scholars as well. So we're very happy to have him here. And as is my duty, I have to remind you of next week's talk as well, which is Russia's Urban Industrial Land, A Story of Gradual Reform, by Professor William Pyle from Middlebury, an economist, which I think should be an interesting talk as well. But that's for next week. You can find our schedule behind you on the tables. You can sign up if you're not already on our mailing list. And there's one third thing there, back there.
Sign-up sheet. Oh, there's a...
Fall.
If you like the semester at a glance, that is also back there. But without further ado, let me turn it over to Professor Gerber.
Okay, thank you very much, Yoy. So this, as Yoy said, I'm basically going to present some survey data, but I'll give you a long preamble and lots of background and lots of story behind the data, and then I'll try to keep the actual number. The methodological part of it to a minimum, although I have to say a little bit about it. So basically, this is a project that I undertook with my colleague Sarah Mendelson some years back, end of 2009, start of 2010. So it's still fairly recent data. And I've presented some of these data before at different CRECA events when CRECA was hosting the Baltic Summer Language Baltic Summer Studies, whatever, BALSI. I presented an initial preliminary take on it. But one of the things I did last year when I was on leave is I started working in more depth with these data. And so what I'm going to show today is the result of the exploration of one particular topic, and that is that of historical memory. So what I'm trying to do, this is, the survey is interesting partly because we looked at, we conducted the survey simultaneously among young people in both Estonia and in Russia at the same time. So it's pretty unusual in survey research to have the ability to make that kind of systematic comparison across two national contexts. And what we're looking at is, what I'm looking at in this particular study is views of the Soviet past. How do young people, young adults, perceive the Soviet experience today in Estonia, and how do they perceive it in Russia? And within Estonia, it's actually quite a controversial topic, as probably most of you realize who are in this room, Estonia is an ethnically divided society where some of the population are ethnic Estonians, and the other half are for the most part, ethnic Russians or Russian speakers. And there have been a series of political conflicts over the years, in the recent past, about various issues that I'll talk about some more. But what I'm going to look at in particular is how these two different parts of Estonia's population, view the Soviet experience through the lens of what we call historical memory. So part of what I'm going to do from a more methodological perspective is try to map the structure of historical memory. I mean, what is historical memory? What are views about the past? They're kind of nebulous concepts which, in a sort of more qualitative research approach, one could talk and conduct interviews with people and talk about the imagery they use or the metaphors or the specific experiences they draw in thinking about the past. But what I'm doing is taking a different approach and trying to understand how do collective groups understand the past. And to do so, I'm going to try to map the different sort of modalities of thinking about the past within larger collectivities and see how those modalities or how different perceptions of the past relate in turn to other variables. And then, in particular, as a sociologist, I mean, one of the things sociologists do is we're very interested in variations between different social groups and in various outcomes, variations, you know, in income, in marriage, in childbearing behavior, also variations in attitudes. So once I map out sort of the different contours, the different positions that one could have or that people actually do have about the past, and it's not just a simple question of, oh, the Soviet Union was great or oh, the Soviet Union was terrible, it's actually more complicated than that. Once I map out those positions, then I'm going to see if views about the past correlate with a series of other variables: ethnicity, country, citizenship, demographic traits, socioeconomic status, language ability, and personal networks. And this is actually a very rich set of variables to have at one's disposal in order to look at this, because all these things could relate in some way or another to views about the past. And it's interesting both from a theoretical sociological perspective, which of them matter and how, but also from a policy and a political perspective, because Estonia, as I said, is a society under experiencing considerable conflict. And so it's interesting to see which of these variables matter. In particular, I'm going to ask the question, do the ethnic differences we observe between the views of the ethnic Russians in Estonia and the Estonians, are they explained, can we account for those differences in terms of some of these other variables which are correlated with ethnicity? Okay. And then I'm going to situate this study in a broader discussion of social science, and you know, historians are involved in this as well, but it's really mainly primarily political scientists who look at historical memory as a political question. So when societies undergo traumatic experiences in the past and they experience a transition to a new circumstance, it's often the case that there are large segments of the populations who are aggrieved by what took place in the past, and there's discussions and debates about whether and how and to what extent those grievances, those angry understandings or senses of injustice about the past should be discussed and brought to the fore and played out in the present in order to complete a successful transition to a new political system that protects human rights and is democratic. So that's known as the transitional justice literature, and how these issues of memory are related to democracy, I think is quite relevant for what's going on in Estonia today. And so I'm going to start by providing some background about that literature. Now, I don't want to get too bogged down, so I'm going to go through this a little bit quickly. So basically, what do I mean by historical memory? Well, I have a definition that I just made up off the top of my head, and you know, maybe some of you could propose improvements, but I mean, I think it's generally discussed as collectively shared and reproduced perceptions and narratives about the recent past that have political resonance in the present. So right away, I think, you know, when we talk, when social scientists talk about historical memory, I mean, it sounds a little bit redundant to say historical memory, but it means something very specific. It's collectively produced narratives, for one thing. So it's not so much, you know, one individual's memory, what happened to them, you know, back in 1944. It's more the collective narratives in a society that are shared and reproduced, and then it has to have some kind of political resonance in the present, just as a sort of definitional state. That's why it's interesting to us as social scientists, precisely because of the political resonance it can or might have in the present context. Okay. And then these issues about historical memory come up in post-authoritarian and post-conflict context. So, for example, post-war Germany and Japan, there was a lot of discussions and a long, drawn-out processes in both those countries about how to come to terms with what their countries and their regimes and their societies did in the Second World War. And you know, some of these issues are still resolved today, like still, you know, in Japanese society, from what I understand, is still debating about, or there are different perceptions about the level of Japanese guilt for various massacres in China, for various types of historical incidents, for its treatment of Koreans, and so forth. Now, Germany is often held up as more of a model of a country that eventually did come to terms and acknowledge its guilt and the atrocities that were committed by its government in the Second World War, but that took some time. It didn't happen that quickly, right? But those are some celebrated cases. Post-dictatorship Chile, Argentina, Spain, other Latin American countries you can show in there. These are all countries that have had conflicts and to a different extent have actually gone after and made efforts to prosecute the perpetrators of crimes against humanity. Well, that's the case in Chile and Argentina. Spain took the opposite approach. Spain negotiated a transition to democracy after Franco died, which involved basically ignoring the Franco regime and pretending that nothing happened and they were just going to, you know, slide on over into democracy without calling to account the perpetrators of human rights crimes during that regime. Right? There are other examples. You know, the whole world abounds with examples of former dictatorships where these issues come up. Post-socialist Eastern Europe and the USSR, these issues are also important, and they've been handled in different ways. I think we're just only now starting to study the different ways that these issues come up in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics. And then, of course, you know, the other recent conflicts as well. So these are fairly widespread conflicts. Well, what role does historical memory play? Well, basically the ideas of the transitional justice literature are the following. That in order, it is argued, for you to have a successful, stable transition to a democratic system, there has to be a public reckoning with the crimes of the past. And that has to involve an acknowledgement of the suffering of the victims. So part of the historical narrative that becomes accepted as the dominant narrative, the official narrative, that has to acknowledge the fact that people were victimized by the prior regime or by some element of the prior regime. And then also, perpetrators have to be held to account, and they should be named, and they should be acknowledged that they did criminal acts against the victims. And this can involve, so in terms of institutions, there are different types of approaches to this process. There's not just sort of one size fits all. It could involve tribunals who read different cases and reach judgments about who was guilty of what. It can involve sometimes amnesties for the perpetrators. Oftentimes it's the case that an amnesty is given to those who committed the crimes in the name of establishing the truth, the argument being that unless you give them amnesty, they're not going to come forward and admit what happened. There's going to be protracted legal fights. And then historical commissions often play a role as well, writing reports, documenting atrocities that took place in the past. Now, there are critics of this perspective who say, well, first of all, they point to Spain empirically as a case where, you know, Spain in the mid-70s after Franco's death, it made this transition to a democratic state and it ignored all these discussions. You couldn't talk publicly about crimes that Franco had committed or Franco and the Falangist Party. Look, you know, they were successful, their economy grew, they've had many decades of democracy since. There is a case that recently these issues have come up again in Spain, and the Spanish, it'd be interesting, the current government might actually have something to say about this, but while that is true, people who would take the transitional justice approach and say, well, Spain, they just delayed it. But the fact remains that Spain was able to make this successful democratic transition without dealing head-on with these issues. Right? There's also the argument that, well, to the extent you dirty up, you bring up these dirty laundry from the past, you create fear on the part of the former supporters of the authoritarian regime, and that creates an incentive for them to oppose the changes, and they could actually undermine the whole process. So it's actually risky to bring up these issues. It might be easier and smoother to just let bygones be bygones, move forward, and focus instead on building new political institutions. All right, so there's a controversy out there about, you know, what approach should be taken about historical memory. Now, divided historical memory comes when there's actually a lot of disagreement about the past, both in terms of what actually happened and in terms of normative questions and issues. And what actually happened, it's actually hard to separate the two. I mean, there are, you know, things did happen. There was a Second World War. But issues about, okay, was Estonia annexed by the Soviet regime, or did Estonia voluntarily join the Soviet regime? Well, I mean, the answer to that question probably depends what you mean by annexed, what you mean by voluntarily joined, what you mean by Estonia, what you mean by the Soviet regime. So it's one can disagree about, so, and there's obviously a normative component that if, you know, if you're an Estonian nationalist and you think that Estonia was forced into the Soviet Union, you would say it was annexed. If you're a believer in the glory of the Soviet Union, you say, well, of course, you know, the Estonians voluntarily joined, they had a vote of some government body to join, and that, so there's a normative component, but there's facts, and it's hard to separate the two, it seems to me. So some people say, well, you know, your variables are measuring the normative component, not so much facts, but I think it's hard to come up with interpretation statements about facts, and I think, you know, probably historians, I would hope, I see David nodding his head, so hopefully they would agree that, you know, that kind of distinction is not always easy to apply. Oftentimes the truth that prevails in terms of public narratives and official is the truth of the victors, those who have defeated the old regime. But when there's not clear victors, when there's still some uncertainty about who's going to be charged, that truth can actually be divided. And so what you get this in some post-socialist contexts, not all of them, but some of them, particularly in the former Soviet republics, not so much in Eastern Europe, where there's more of a consensus that, you know, the Soviet system was imposed by a foreign occupying force and everything was bad and we didn't do anything wrong, it's just they came and made us do all this stuff. But, in the former Soviet republics, there's more ambivalence towards these questions because it's not really clear, you know, especially the case in Russia, it's not really clear who the victors are in the fall of communism, all right? And so there's no sort of commonly accepted narrative about, you know, this glorious democratic overthrow of communism in Russia, for example. And so there's a lot of uncertainty about the truth, about what happened, the legacy of the Soviet Union. Was the Soviet system good or bad? Now, it's also the case, particularly in the former Soviet space, that memory about Soviet Union has become a tool in propaganda struggles, and it's been used quite explicitly by the Putin regime to try to legitimize its current policies and its current rule by portraying itself as as having inherited this legacy of the Soviet Union's achievements and trying to preserve those achievements and trying to celebrate the Soviet experience as opposed to denigrating it and criticizing it. And then there have been counter efforts in Ukraine and in Estonia and other places which have run up against the particular celebration from a Russian nationalist perspective of the Soviet Union. So, you know, Russia, we'll start with Russia and we'll get to Estonia. So Russia has a long history of arguments about the Soviet system and about its own history. And, you know, Khrushchev's speech, I put that up there. So Khrushchev, as you know, gave this speech where he denounced Stalin's crimes. It was a secret speech, but it was leaked out. So that's one case of an attempt to sort of at least throw a different wrinkle, at least to start to break sort of the dominant narrative, the dominant understanding of history, the collective understanding of what happened in the Stalin era. But it didn't compare at all, of course, to Gorbachev's glasnost, a time where, you know, by the end of the 1990s, there was a much more thoroughgoing discussion and criticism of the bad aspects of the Soviet system and the brutalities it inflicted on the population, the extent of the Gulag, the Great Terror, the repressions, the de-kulakization, the deportation of entire groups of, I mean, what could go on and on, I don't need to give you more examples, but, you know, the Gorbachev period was the first time in Soviet history where there was really a forthright discussion and debate about these types of issues. Now then, after the Soviet Union collapsed, Yeltsin found it in his advantage to also denounce the Soviet regime and Soviet institutions. And as long as he did, he also promoted a thoroughgoing historical critique. And this really came to the fore in the 1996 election campaign, where it looked for a while like Yeltsin was going to lose, but to Zhuganov, the Communist Party membership. And there was then a massive propaganda campaign showing TV ads of, you know, bulldozing corpses from the Gulag and saying, you know, remember all these awful things the communists did, and if you vote for Zhuganov, you're going to vote for that again. And so that was really the pinnacle of the sort of clear denunciation of the Soviet past under Yeltsin. But then, of course, throughout this period, there was a nationalist and communist backlash in Russia. The economic crisis then formed its own sort of memory context where, in the perspective of the 2000s, looking back to the 1990s and associating that period with a time when everything was chaotic and life was very miserable and there were people lost sort of meaning in their lives, and they associate that with the word democracy and with these denunciations of the Soviet era. So that's an interesting point as well. Well, recently, and by recently I mean sort of the second half of the 90s, there's a clear push by Putin and his associates to link the current administration with the glorious achievements of the Soviet past. And I don't want to get into this too much, but this was associated with a very heavy-handed politicization of history. And they pointed to a history commission, which was actually recently disbanded. But for a number of years, it was tasked with trying to root out anti-Russian or pro-fascist historians who were making arguments that were seek to denigrate and insult the record. I forget what the word is. I think it was any apologies for fascism, which was widely interpreted as a witch hunt against people who wrote critical accounts of Soviet behavior during World War II and Soviet policies during World War II. So that kind of fizzled out, but it was emblematic of a real attempt on the part of the Putin government to restore this notion that the Soviet Union was a glorious era and had many glorious achievements. Okay, so it was part of a consolidation story. This is a whole attempt to foster Soviet nostalgia through textbooks and speeches and films. I don't want to get too bogged into this, but Putin himself said in 2005, in his State of the Union speech, the equivalent thereof, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. World War II, an imagery about the Soviet victory in World War II, became a key part of state propaganda. There were even attempts to sort of justify the Nazi-Soviet pact. There were issues that the Baltic states had hoped for the Russians would apologize for occupying them, and it never materialized. There are continuing denials of Soviet responsibility for the massacre of Polish officers and elites at Katyn Forest until they did eventually recognize it in 2010. And then there were attempts to rehabilitate Stalin in various ways. Now, there was a backlash in Ukraine, so Ukraine sort of took the opposite approach with the election of Yushchenko. There was the Bronze Night in Tallinn, which I'll share more about. Okay, so there you have the details. The commission for countering attempts to falsify history to the detriment of Russia's interest. That was the name of that commission. And the OSCE then in turn denounced this sort of glorification of the Soviet Union. So in the OSCE in June 2009 signed a declaration equating Nazism with Stalinism. And so it was quite clear that these issues of history, I mean, the point of all this is, these are not just kind of interest to academics, but these are really geopolitically important debates in terms of how to understand Soviet history. Right? So there's some examples of the celebration of Stalin. There are plans to adorn Moscow with big posters of Stalin in connection with the 2010 Victory Day Parade. There is still today this plaque in the Kursk Metro Station honoring Stalin. Now, there was also a countermove. So this stuff is complicated. And just when it seemed like the Russian government was just moving whole hog into a celebration of the Soviet period, you also had Medvedev in October 30th, 2009, in a video blog denouncing quite forthrightly the repressions of the 1930s. The Russian government did acknowledge Soviet involvement in Katyn Forest, and tragically, as we know, much of the Polish government died when they were in a plane flying to the commemorative event in which the Russians were participating. And then the History Commission was recently disbanded because they said it was no longer necessary. All right, what about Estonia? Well, Estonia for centuries was ruled by other foreign powers. It did have a brief period of independence after the First World War, but then the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact assigned it to the Soviet Union, and so it was annexed by Soviet troops and Soviet troops moved in June 1940. There were massive executions, deportations, particularly of elites, but you know, no one knows exactly what the numbers were, but it's estimated, you know, roughly 10% of Estonia's population was either deported to Siberia or executed at a very early phase of the Soviet occupation. Now, the Nazis invaded in June 1941, and indeed, there's a lot of evidence that the Nazis were initially greeted as liberators by the Estonian population, who were quite upset at what the Soviets had been doing to them. But then, of course, the Nazis had their own set of harsh policies, and the Estonians were unhappy about that as well. The Soviet army retook Estonia in fall of 1944, and another round of even harsher executions and repressions of the local population set in because they were accused of having collaborated and so forth. So yeah, so there you get that estimate about roughly 10% of the population were killed or deported to Siberia, and the elite population in particular was targeted by the Soviets. So then there was a long period of Soviet rule, and Estonia was integrated into the Soviet system. So the Soviet economic system was opposed, the political system. One of the important developments was a massive in-migration of Russians during this time, which the Estonians saw as a product of a deliberate state policy to de-Estonianize their country or their republic. But basically, you know, wages were much higher, working conditions were higher, so the Russian government indeed seemed to encourage the large in-migration of Russians over this 45-year period. And so that transformed the population of the republic to one where a substantial proportion, about 30%, a third of the population, were Russian speakers, you know, mainly Russians, also Belarusians, Ukrainians, and so forth, by the time Estonia gained its independence, which it did in 1991. After the Glasnost period, it installed a parliamentary democracy. Estonia quite quickly oriented itself toward the West, especially the Nordic countries, Finland in particular, because Estonian and Finnish language are the same language family, joined EU and the EU and NATO in the 2000s. Estonia actually joined the Eurozone in January of 2011, which is kind of interesting timing. I am still holding on to some old Estonian krona. I guess they're crowns, right? Which I wasn't able to change last time I was there. But anyway, so one big issue with Estonia's transition is what to do with these Russian immigrants. And Estonia didn't automatically grant them citizenship, even to those who had been born in Estonia, on the grounds that they were part of an occupying force. So it did, however, provide a means of assimilation. So Russians who wanted to get citizenship, they could do so after passing a series of tests, the most difficult of which was a language test. And so many Russians, Russians had lived in these enclaves, they maintained the Russian language. Very few of them actually learned Estonian during the Soviet period. And so it was quite a stiff barrier for them to have to learn the language. Some of them did, a lot of them didn't. So even today, about a third of the Russian-speaking population, which is 8% nowadays of the overall population of the country, are non-citizens. They live in Estonia, they live their whole lives there, most of them. They don't have citizenship in Estonia or any other country. It's not that they're Russian citizens either, although Russia is happy to grant them citizenship if they go and apply. They have gray passports, which just say resident of Estonia, alien resident of Estonia, which they actually can use to travel freely both in the EU and the former Soviet space. And so some say, well, you know, you have to travel on this passport from Vladivostok to Lisbon. Why would you want to get citizenship? A EU passport, you know, you need to get a visa to go to Russia. But anyway, there's reports of discrimination, and there's been growing tension between Russia and Estonia geopolitically, and within Estonia between Russian nationalists and the Estonian population. This culminated in the Bronze Night incident, when the Estonian government removed a World War II memorial and took it to a cemetery where Russians had traditionally gathered on Victory Day to celebrate the Soviet victory in the war, provoked some riots and protests, and Russia reacted very harshly diplomatically against Estonia. There was a cyber war against the Estonian government, so you're probably familiar with a lot of these things. I just bring this up to once again show that these issues about history, I mean, remember this was a memorial to a World War II soldier, right? So it was a symbol of the past. It was a representation of how we should think about the past. And it became the focus of both a domestic crisis, riots, confrontations, in which people died, property was destroyed, and also a geopolitical controversy, right? So these things really do matter. And this anger on both sides, and here's just a typical quote, there's still a very harsh rhetoric coming out of Russia about Estonia, so these types of words are often banding about. There's discussions on the Russia Today, which is sort of a mouthpiece for the Russian government, I would argue. I mean, maybe no one, people might disagree with that characterization, but it's a formerly free media station which the Russian government finances. And, and there was a 2009 broadcast where they talked about this criminal discrimination against Russians by Estonia's apartheid regime. Okay? So this is an EU state which is democratic and so forth, but it's characterized as an apartheid regime. So there's divided perceptions of the Russian past, there's issues about citizenship, about the socioeconomic integration of Russian speakers, there's tensions with Russia. And these memory divisions, in this case, they appear to overlap with the ethnic divisions within Russia. That Russians, you know, based on what we observed in the Bronze Night Incident, they see the legacy of the Soviet Union in World War II in one way, Estonians in another way. Estonians don't think it was worth celebrating the fact that the Soviets, you know, won the Second World War, because for them, they weren't better, they didn't perceive themselves as being all that much worse off. In fact, many perceive themselves as being better off under the Nazi occupation than under the Soviets. In fact, there's a plaque in the museum. There's a museum of memory in the Tallinn, and there is a plaque, an exhibit there, which says quite clearly, you know, the Nazi occupation was bad, but things were worse under the Soviet Union. So there's not that much ambivalence about that statement. And you know, to a lot of us in the West, the way we think about the Second World War, that's kind of shocking to hear. That is clearly a perspective. So, empirically, what am I looking at? Well, so there are these ethnic divisions, but there are also the Estonians and Russians differ in other ways. So one question is, to what extent are they observed, the apparent, you know, so how extensive are these from a quantitative perspective? I mean, yeah, people write in the streets, and people write tracts, and they say things, they put plaques in museums, but really, what do these populations really think overall? And survey research offers a way to really get at that you can't get through other more anecdotal approaches. So the research questions that drive this study is, what is the structure of historical memory among young people? We really focus particularly on those, I think it's 18 to 29 years old in our samples, because you know they didn't really live that much. I mean, some of them were alive during the Soviet period, but really they're relying, since they have a perception of the Soviet past, it's not based on their own lived experience, it's based on what they know from public discourse, from talking to their family members and learning from their parents, and from learning in school. So I think they're a better test case of the role of these historical narratives that are out there as opposed to the role of lived experience. And I think it's neat that we have the data from Russia as well, so we can compare the views of the Russians in Estonia with their same cohorts of Russians in Russia. Then also, how are these perceptions associated with these other variables, country, citizenship, demographic traits, etc.? All right. So what do? We conducted focus groups with Russian speakers in Estonia in March of 2009, three in Tallinn, one in Narva, which is a heavily Russian enclave by the border. And then we did this survey of, 16 to 29-year-olds in Estonia, both in Estonian and Russian. So we purposely had an oversample of non-citizens, Estonian Russians. The data were collected by an Estonian polling organization. Pretty good response rate. We ended up with equally divided samples. So this was by design, half Estonian, half Russian. And we looked hard to find 338 non-citizens. It was actually quite difficult to do so. We ended up reproducing more or less the population average. It was hard to find them, particularly in this young cohort, many of whom did actually get citizenship. And we had 12 questions on the survey of measuring perceptions of the Soviet past, and we conducted the same survey in Russia at the same time. So I'm going to skip through this really quickly, but basically we used a quantitative technique called latent class analysis. And the way latent class analysis works is that, all right, so you have a bunch of questions. We have 12 questions, and I'll show you these questions, all of which, to one extent or another, measure views about the Soviet past. And that's great from a data perspective, because the more measures you have of some underlying construct of interest, the better. But it poses a problem in terms of analysis. It's very cumbersome and unwieldy to conduct 12 different analyses of 12 different dependent variables, each of which is a measure of the past, but each of which also measures other things. So there's no sort of perfect way to measure attitudes about the past. So if you're diligent and you have the resources, you can afford to, you know, spend the time on the survey, what you do is you ask a lot of different questions, each of which you think measures some element of use of the past. And then when you do the analysis, though, you can't analyze 12 different dependent variables. It's too unwieldy. You would have 12 times however many analyses you do, and it's just not possible. So what you do is you need a technique that allows you to combine information from these 12 original variables you have into a more limited set of variables, and then you can analyze those. Now, the most common way of doing this is something called factor analysis, but factor analysis is a technique that's suitable when your variables are continuous. That is, when they represent quantitative scales on which people can be ranked. The questions we have about the past aren't really of that nature. I mean, so in some stark way, you could suggest there's two polar extremes. You know, the Soviet past was awful versus the Soviet past was great, but there's actually a lot of nuanced variation between. So, and there's a lot of people who answer ambivalently about these questions, or they say they don't know, or they refuse to answer the question. So latent class is a technique that's used to combine these different, what we call categorical variables, where the responses are not a linearly distributed scale, but represent discrete categories. So something like religion, you know, you could be Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim. You can't really rank those according to some intrinsic scale. I mean, you could rank them according to income or some other external factor, but there's no way. I mean, it would be arbitrary what order you put those on some survey, right? Whereas something like age, that's an example of linear variable. Well, factor or latent class analysis is a technique used to take categorical variables and extract from them an underlying set of latent classes, which are then what you use in the next phase of the analysis. So that's what I did here. And there's formulas and equations, and I'm not going to bother with those. Lots of verbiage. So the other wrinkle is, so the way it works is you try to say, okay, well, how many different underlying perspectives are there about the Soviet past? And then you look at the data to test different hypotheses about the number of underlying latent classes that there are. And you look at the data and see what's the optimal fitting model. What model provides the best prediction of the distribution of responses to the variables that you have, which we call manifest variables. And so I run that, and it tells me, and it will also tell me how many latent classes are there. And then within those latent classes, it'll tell me what's the probability, if somebody's in that latent class, what's the probability of having each response that's observed on the observable variables. I actually have to do this in two stages, because 12 variables is sort of too many to do in a big latent class analysis. There's too many cells with 12 variables, because basically you look at the multi-weight distribution across all the variables. And so in the first level, I extract three sets of latent classes from three different sets of manifest variables for each. And then I perform that again. I assign my response to those latent classes, and then I do it a second time. So then I come up with one final set of latent classes. All right, that's enough for methodology. So, question? All right. So and just to give you a flavor, here's some quotes from focus groups to show you sort of the extent of passions over these issues. These are Estonian Russians that I would have loved to do Estonians too, but I don't speak Estonian, and I didn't really want to do a focus group in English. It would have seemed strange. Russians said, you know, Estonians are a Ku Klux Klan without clubs. They think to themselves and sometimes say aloud, get out of here, and that's it. That's their main wish, all right? They are concerned about the citizenship issue. The standard term for us is we are non-Estonians. I don't want to be a non-Estonian. You know, why am I non-Estonian? What does that mean? That's sort of how they think of us. I love talent. I love the streets. But somehow they won't let us love it. They won't allow us to, and so forth. I mean, there's more ambivalent views as well. I don't want to go.
Can you just say what the current citizenship
policies for these young people? So they're, let's say, how old are they? 18 years old or something?
Yeah, it could be 18 to 20 or...
So they're born in Estonia, but they don't get... So who gets citizenship?
Well, I think if you're born, if your parents have citizenship, then you can... You have to prove that your parents were Estonian citizens, basically, at some point in Estonia's free, or your ancestors were. So that basically says that you have to prove that you were related to an Estonian citizen who was a member, a citizen of Estonia in the interwar period, or else since.
So ethnic Estonians, is that the basic criteria?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically, it's a legalistic way of restricting it to ethnic. Ethnic Estonians get it automatically. Ethnic Russians, I think if they're born to parents who are citizens, they get it. But if they're not, they have to go through a naturalization process, even if they live their whole lives in the country. But, citizenship is more common among the younger people because it's easier for them to learn language and then. All right, well, let me jump ahead to the sort of a quantum. So here's just an example of how divided views are in Estonia between the Russian and the Estonian population. So this is a question about the Bronze Knight. We asked him, was it the right decision to move the Bronze Monument to a military cemetery in April 2007? And the red bars represent the Russians, the blue, the Estonians. So the Estonians overwhelmingly say, yes, it was the right decision, either definitely or probably. The Russians overwhelmingly say, no, probably or definitely. I mean, there's some opinion. But that's really pretty stark. There's not much common ground. And a lot of these questions are like this. There's really sharp divisions over lots of current political issues you asked about. So we asked, here just to give you a sense of these different samples. Now, our data allow me to not only distinguish Russians from Estonians within Estonia, but also to distinguish citizens of Estonia. So these are Russian ethnics who are citizens from non-citizens. And part of the argument over citizenship, so those, aside from the Russians, who argue that Estonia should relax its citizenship policies, make a practical argument. They say, so Estonians' rationale for doing so is that these were occupiers and they came in and it violates our sense of our self-determination to make them citizens. But the principal argument is that, well, by not granting them citizenship, you're creating a problem for yourselves because you're making it impossible for them to integrate socioeconomically. You're creating this permanent sort of underclass within the society. And that just doesn't look good. It gives the Russian government grist for its propaganda mill against you. And also, it creates problems and tensions within your society. So once you give them citizenship, then it'll be easier to integrate them into your society. So one question is, does citizenship actually mitigate the divisions over historical memory? And to answer that, I'm going to compare the Estonian Russians and who have citizenship with those who don't, and see if they differ in terms of how they view the past. Also, within Russia, I have Russian ethnics, and I also have a much smaller sample, so there's not too much I can do with that. But I also have some non-ethnic Russians in the Russian sample. And then, of course, I have Estonians. So I actually have five groups. And so you can see the numbers here. There's not much variation in gender, although among the non-citizens, those are the gray passport holders, there are fewer women. They're about the same age. So even the non-citizens, 96% of them were born in Estonia. So it's not really a question of them having immigrated as children. They're almost all Estonian born. The Russian population in Estonia is concentrated in Tallinn and other large cities, so there's very small rural population, which we know to be the case. There are socioeconomic differences. So the citizens are better educated than the non-citizens. They have higher earnings, so they're less likely to be in the bottom income quintile. And the Estonians are even less so. Some are more likely to be in the top income quintile, substantially less likely to be employed. So citizenship really does have a socioeconomic significance among the Russian population in Estonia. We asked the response, do they speak English fluently? In Estonia, we asked them, do they speak Estonian fluently? We didn't want to ask that in Russia because very few Russians speak Estonian. It would have seemed silly. We have enough questions about Estonian and some of the Russian. We had to take out some of the Estonian questions because the pretest of Russian, why are you asking all these questions about Estonia? I don't care about Estonia. You know? So we had to modify some of our hopes. I think we had a filter question, like, if you don't care about Estonia, then you kind of skipped a lot of time. But the history questions we did ask of everyone, so that we could get them. Only 24% of the citizens even say they speak Estonian fluently, 37% say they speak it well, and clearly language is a barrier to citizenship. Now, we also asked them about the ethnic composition of their co-workers, if they're working, and if they're friends. And so this is where we get into social networks. We thought that, you know, maybe Russians who hang out more with Estonians, maybe they share their view of history and vice versa. If Estonians have a lot of friends at work co-workers who are Russians, maybe that influences their views. We wanted to test for that kind of effect as well. And then we asked them, do you have a relative in your family who was victimized during the Soviet era by arbitrary repressions from the government? So you would expect that to also affect people's views of the past. And it does, although not necessarily the way you would think. Okay, so here are the variables, and I'm gonna have to really rush through this and get to the punchline. So just give you a sense of the questions that we ask people. They're all sort of strongly disagree to strongly agree statements. So during the Second World War, many Estonians collaborated with the fascists, all right? I mean, that involves a normative judgment as well as a fact. The years of fascist occupation were less harsh for Estonia than the years of Soviet power. Stalin does not deserve credit for the victory over fascism in the Second World War. Some say the USSR's participation in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was shameful. Others think it was that's just part of the question. We had a balancing statement. Others think it was necessitated by the needs of the day or something like that. What do you think? Was it shameful? Was it not shameful? Okay? So this gives you the distribution, and these are all questions about views about the Second World War. And you can see, by and large, you probably can't see these numbers too well, but the Estonian views differ from the views of the Russians. So the Russians are much more likely to agree that many Estonians collaborated with the fascists. The Estonians are more likely to disagree. Okay, years of the fascist occupation were less harsh. Well, very few Russians agree with that at all. It's not that the majority of Estonians agree, but they're more likely to agree. A lot of them say don't know, which in this case could be, well, we agree, but we don't really want to say so. Stalin does not deserve credit for the victory of fascism. Well, the Russians disagree with that. They think Stalin does deserve credit. The Estonians, they agree Stalin does not deserve credit. So on all these questions, it's pretty clear. There's some variation. But you see what the problem is. I only have four questions so far. I actually have another eight questions. And for me to go through each one of them, it's really not possible to do so.
Don't you find it surprising how many people have never heard of Molotov-Ribbentrop?
Yeah.
I mean, especially for Russians.
These are 16 to 29-year-olds. How many American 16 to 29-year-olds have heard of the Vietnam War?
Have heard of the Vietnam War? I don't know. I'm surprised by that level of, I mean.
You think it, you expect it to be fewer, don't they?
I know,
it's kind of an arcade. I mean. I don't know. I wasn't that surprised.
Not necessarily part of the heroic story of the Great Patriot's War.
Yeah. Estonians and Russians, and for smaller countries, it's also a bigger issue. The Russians, they usually.
Yeah, and Russia's just probably about, all that stuff about World War II. And how much in Russian school books, this is one of the questions, like how much have they taught this cohort about things like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which don't make the Soviet Union look so good? I'm not going to say that they ignored it completely, but I'm sure there was other things that they emphasized more when talking about that epic in the history that might have stuck. Yeah. All right, so then.
By the same token, I'm surprised that there's such a high apathy rate about the treaty among Estonians, 42%.
42% say they have no opinion. Yeah, that's kind of.
Because that's central to all the sort of liberation narratives.
But again, these are young people. I mean, you're right. I agree. But these are young people, and maybe all this stuff about history, they just It's not central to their concerns, although you know other variables do suggest that. There's a lot of don't knows on the line question. All right, so then there's four more questions about Stalin in particular. Did he do more good than bad, even though he made some mistakes? Was he a cruel tyrant? Was he a wise leader? Was he directly responsible for imprisonment, torture, and death of millions? You know, stuff like that. But those are clearly all related to Stalin. And then four more questions just about the Soviet legacy in general, the Soviet occupation period. The Soviets liberated Estonia from the fascists. They treated Estonians brutally. Estonia joined the USSR voluntarily. Russia should apologize to the Baltic states for the Soviet occupation. It is controversial how many innocent people were deported from the Baltic republics under Stalin. What do you think? Was it hundreds of thousands? Many, but less than 100,000, fewer, none, don't know, hard to say. Okay, so you know, two-thirds of the Estonians think it was hundreds of thousands. Far fewer Russians think so.
I don't know rules again.
So that is a question about fact, I guess. But again, normatively too. All right, so basically, I'm going to just zip through. So I did a bunch of late class analysis. I have a lot of numbers. So just to give you a flavor of how this works, so the five-class solution is the statistically optimal one in each case, and I have five classes, and when you're a member of a class, that's associated with the probability of having each response, and so you can kind of interpret the what that class means from these responses. So this class are the class of don't knows, and they're labeled as such because they're most likely to say don't know, you know, to each of these questions. I mean, so here they're kind of, I mean, it's a little bit muddy, less clear-cut than it is for those other questions. They've never heard of the Molotov, the pact, or they say they have no opinion. And so that's the neat thing about latent class analysis as opposed to factor analysis, where you have to put someone somewhere on a continuum. But here, you're not bound by that constraint, so you can identify the people who don't know. And so what the number is at the very first row, that's the percentage of the people in the overall sample who fall into that latent class. So 31% of the sample are these kind of don't know, ambivalent, who they're tuned out, or they're, for whatever reason, they don't want to express an opinion on these surveys. There's moderate adherents of the pro-Soviet narrative who agree somewhat, modally agree somewhat that the many Estonians collaborated, who are kind of divided but tend, if anything, to disagree somewhat that the fascist occupation was less harsh than Soviet power. They tend to, again, they're kind of divided, but they fall in balance on the disagree somewhat that Stalin does not deserve credit, so they tend to think he does deserve credit, but not strongly. And they tend to say that the Molotov von Ribbentrop was not shameful, but they also are reluctant to express. So, you know, by and large, they kind of are straddling the fence, but tilting in favor of supporting the pro-Soviet perspective. Then that's 30%. Then there's those who are critical. Okay, so they take the more anti. I mean, here's one case where they take the strongest anti-Soviet, anti-official, pro-Soviet narrative position. Also, they're more likely to say it's shameful, the pact. Okay, they don't come down strongly necessarily, but few people do, in terms of the fascist occupation. Then there's the strong defenders of the Soviet narrative and so forth. And then there's the refuseniks, who actually are more likely to just refuse to answer on all these questions. So that's how latent class analysis works. That is the structure of memory in this population with regard to the Soviet past. There's five basic perspectives, which I've derived empirically. I didn't come in advance saying, I think these are the five experiments. I've just used the data to inform me about what those perspectives are. All right, so I did this also with the views of Stalin measures. I won't go through them. Also with the Soviet treatment of the Baltics measures. And in each case, there are five latent classes. And then, so then I assigned people to those latent classes based on the class that they're most likely, it's a latent variable, so you actually don't know what they are, but you can make a very educated guess depending on how they answered those manifest questions. You assign to latent classes, you do the whole thing again, and then you come up with five sort of master latent classes that combine their views about the war, their views about Stalin, and their views about the Soviet occupation of the Baltics. And once again, you get a very similar pattern. You get moderate adherents of the pro-Soviet narrative is one wing class, rejection of the pro-Soviet narrative, don't knows, strong adherence to the pro-Soviet narrative, and then refusings. So that is my ultimate answer to the question of this: what is the structure of historical memory? Then I run a bunch of multivariate analyses using a technique called multivariate logistic regression, and I'm going to sum those up, or you get lots of numbers. It's all very fun for numbers and statistician people. It's a little bit complicated because you have all these categorical dependent variables. So let me skip over this and tell you what the punchline is. So the big finding here is that there's huge differences in the probability of falling into these different historical camps by ethnicity, by country, and by citizenship. And the controlling for all these other variables does little or nothing to mitigate those differences. And all three factors matter. But it really is the case that it's ethnicity that's the driving force. That's the biggest kind of cleavage you have in controlling for people's socioeconomic status, their education, whether who their friends are, whether they speak English, gender, all these things which could be correlated with ethnicity, it doesn't matter. It doesn't wipe out the effect. Estonians are much more likely to be critical of the Soviet legacy and much less likely to be strong supporters. And then in those ambivalent categories, there's not always a clear-cut distinction. So there are, something's going on in those intermediate categories as well, which is important to take account of. But so they could be roughly equally to be moderate adherents of the post-Soviet narrative. The Estonian-Russian non-citizens, so the Estonian Russians who are gray passport holders, they are the most pro-Soviet of anybody. If you compare them to the Russians who live in Russia, the Estonian Russians are more likely to endorse the Soviet experience, less likely to be critical of it than even the Russian young people in Russia are. All right? There is a difference by citizenship among the Estonian Russians. So it says the gray passport holders who are the most radical of all, but there's still a large gap between the Estonian Russians who are naturalized citizens and the Estonians. So citizenship, to the extent we can interpret these differences as having some effect on views of history and not vice versa, and that's certainly debatable whether you can do so, but it's not going to solve this historical divide. Even if you were to make all the Russians citizens, all right, it's not going to, and that had the corresponding effect on their views, it's not going to close this gap. There's still going to be a huge gap between the Russians and the Estonians. Also, Russians in the Russian Federation are the most likely group to be in those don't know. So they're the most likely to just, all this history stuff, I don't know. Don't ask. All right, there are some other results of other variables I'll mention briefly. Women, interestingly enough, are more likely to be don't-knows and more likely to refuse to say. And this comes up a lot in attitude surveys I've done in Russia, where women are more likely to just say, oh, I don't know, it's about politics, especially political questions. So it sort of confirms stereotypes of Russian women as being less interested in politics than men. And whenever I present this in Russia, all the women nod. Education. Interestingly enough, education and English language only have an effect in that they reduce the likelihood of being in the don't know or the refuse to say categories. They're not associated one way or the other with a particular assessment of the Russian past, which is surprising. I would have thought English language maybe it makes people more anti-Soviet. There's very little variation by socioeconomic difference. There's really nothing to speak of. Among the Estonian Russians, those who are the least educated are the most likely to adhere to the pro-Soviet view, but they're also less likely to moderate. So there is some effect of low education, those with less than high school among the Estonian Russians, they do tend to be sort of more strongly pro-Soviet and somewhat less moderately pro-Soviet, correspondingly. Estonian language has a polarizing effect among the ethnic Russians. So controlling for all these other things, citizenship and everything else, Russians who speak Estonian, it doesn't necessarily make them more critical of the Soviet, the pro-Soviet historical narrative. In fact, at the same time, it makes them more likely to reject that narrative and also more likely to adhere to it strongly, which is interesting. So again, teaching them all the ethnic Russians Estonian and making them learn Estonian based on these results is not going to have the effect. It's just going to make them less likely to sort of be in the middle and to take a side one way or the other. Personal networks do have the strong intuitive effects that we would think. So having more Russians in your network makes you less likely to reject the pro-Soviet narrative, whether or not you're Estonian or Russian to begin with, and more likely to adhere strongly to the pro-Soviet narrative. And then, actually, the relative of having a victim, or a relative who's a victim, has ambiguous effects, surprisingly enough. That is, it doesn't necessarily make people more anti-Soviet. It also, in some cases, makes people more pro-Soviet and more anti-Soviet at the same time. It reduces the likelihood that you're going to be in the don't know or the moderate pro-Soviet category. It pushes you to one or the other extreme. All right, so those are the empirical findings. So in brief, the conclusion then, so all the, you know, ethnicity, country, and citizenship, these factors all shape divisions. Estonians are especially critical of the pro-Soviet narrative, as we would expect. There's nothing surprising there. Citizenship does close the gap some, but the gap still remains quite strong, so it's not very encouraging news for those who would like the Estonian government to relax the citizenship policies in the name of practical gains. Because the Estonian government could look at the results and say, well, it's not really going to make that much difference, so why should we? Estonian Russians, they seem to be more engaged on this topic than Russian Federation Russians, so they're less likely to be in the don't know or hard to say category. It means more to Russian ethnics who live in Estonia than it does to Russians in Russia. And these effects of citizenship, ethnicity, and country persist net of control. So the fundamental divide really is along ethnic lines. It's not a mask for socioeconomic or some other type of differences. The social segregation of Estonians contributes to this gap in historical memory because of this effect of hanging out with Russians. And you know, naturally, the Russian respondents are more likely to have predominantly Russian colleagues at work and predominantly Russian friends. So that does feed into this. So, you know, programs to encourage more social interaction between Russians and Estonians, that might actually have some more of an effect than the language training and so forth. Studies of divided memory. So these other variables, they don't really matter that much. Studies of divided memory, they really should attend to the systematic structure of these divisions. I mean, people, you know, they often recognize that there's differences of opinion, but there aren't too many studies of this nature that really use survey data to try to map out how strong the various cleavages are and to try to get a sense of, you know, what really matters in shaping these divisions, views about the past. And so I think in other contexts, it would also be very instructive to conduct surveys of this nature and do this type of analysis. But unfortunately, the final conclusion is not so optimistic. It's that these ethnic overlapping cleavages between ethnicity and memory. So when ethnicity plays such a strong role in shaping these cleavages over memory, right? It's not a very good situation for reducing tensions between the ethnic groups, because the ethnic differences and the memory differences reinforce one another rather than counteracting one another. And so it's not a very promising prognosis for social tranquility in Estonian society so long as these divisions overlap to the extent they do. Thank you.